Atheist. Wait, did I say bonus daddies? I meant buenas tardes and welcome to Ask an Atheist. With me in the studio are Josh. Welcome. We haven't heard you in a while.
Hi.
And Dan. Welcome back also to the studio. Haven't heard you in a while.
Hello.
So this bonus daddies, I just am so tickled by it because, as you know, I'm a high school teacher and I'm a high school Spanish teacher. And, you know, Spanish has just started up for the year because school has just started up for the year. And so on our very first quiz, I got something completely new. I love novelty. It's awesome, right? Been teaching 12 years. You have the same standard quiz all the time of what's a greeting that you can use at any time of day? And everyone's supposed to write hola. And what's a greeting that you can only use in the morning time? And people are supposed to write buenos dias. What's a greeting that you can only use in the evening time? And people are supposed to write buenas noches. And of course, what's a greeting you can only use for the afternoon time? And what did I get? Bonus daddies. And I was just so tickled by that. So, buenas tardes, everyone. Buenas tardes. I can understand my wonderful, you know, teacher-ness through my own pedagogical introspection that perhaps maybe someone new to the phonemes of Spanish could possibly parse buenas tardes as buenas tardes. It's still my funniest thing that's happened in several years.
I still like to say from a Goof Troop. Back in the day.
Is that the bogus nachos?
Oh, sorry. Hasta la bagel.
Hasta la bagel.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Hasta la bagel.
La bagel.
It's kind of incredible that the staying power of Arnold Schwarzenegger and how it's just sort of burned into our consciousness and Terminator, that came out like, you know, 15 years before most of my high school students were born. Or some grandiose number like that. We still hear, as I'm teaching all of the goodbyes of the adios and chao and hasta mañana, and you get to hasta luego or hasta la bagel. you get eventually down to hasta la vista, and without fail, some kid in the background as they're writing down all their notes will go, baby. Just testament to funny accents and overly violent, groundbreaking films. But anyway, speaking of ridiculous things with staying power, we have some news from Alabama. Former Alabama State Supreme Court Chief Justice Roy Moore beat incumbent Luther Strange in the Republican Senate primary runoff. Why is this noteworthy? Well, while Donald Trump had backed Strange, Moore had the support of Breitbart boss and former Trump associate Steve Bannon, as well as failed vice president candidate and reality show mom Sarah Palin. Moore is known for defying constitutional prohibitions against the establishment of religion by placing Ten Commandments monuments in his own courtroom and later in the state Supreme Court, an action that got him removed from the bench by a judicial ethics panel. But after being reelected to the court in 2012, Moore violated rulings on marriage equality and resigned before the same ethics panel ruled on further action against him. This is the guy that could be joining the Senate. And of course, this is the Senate seat that's left vacant by Jeff Sessions. So this is the guy that could be, you know, one of 100 lawmakers for our federal government.
More than it's a small possibility. It's scary. I mean, he might get a nice running from Jones, but it doesn't.
This is Doug Jones, the Democratic primary winner.
Who's a very well-respected attorney general, former attorney general.
In Alabama?
In Alabama.
Okay.
But it doesn't look good. And this is bad because, I mean, if anything Sessions is bad, Moore is like three Sessions stacked on top of each other, which still isn't very high. I mean, Sessions is kind of like a Keebler elf, but, you know.
Okay, so three Keebler. Hey, you know, people have different vertical challenges, and we don't want to insult on that alone, because there's plenty of things to insult Jeff Sessions over, and plenty of things to... Now, is Roy Moore actually, is he the one that's like really, really tall? Isn't there a guy?
No, actually, that was Strange. Strange is, and in fact, I think it was... Trump has a tendency to like tall people, so that's probably the people are trying to see if that's why he actually backed Strange. But Strange is over 6 feet tall. I think he's like 6'7", I believe.
This is the guy that gets called Big Luther.
Yeah, he towers over you.
Okay. So we brought up Moore on this show before. We brought up Roy Moore when he was the keynote speaker for the Pierce County Chamber of Commerce, and he was the keynote speaker, and all of the city of Tacoma city council members boycotted that. They didn't make any municipal appearance. You know, usually if you got a big convention going on in your city, Even if it's a county chamber of commerce, you know, you make an appearance saying I'm a public official and your business is important to our city. Yeah, everyone from Tacoma City Council boycotted going to that because you had Roy Moore. And this is at a time that he was making known his extremely, you know, negative views on gay folks. And, you know, when you have in city government in Tacoma, like a quarter of your legislators or your city leaders that are, you know, gay, maybe you don't want to expect them to support your vile, you know, proclamations against gay folks. And it was a very strange pointed thing to bring up this dude from Alabama all the way to this little corner of the country for a business meeting when clearly this guy isn't so much about business as he is about religion. Do you guys remember or have you heard some of the stuff that he said about gay folks and about God's natural law and all that kind of business?
I mean, he's definitely trying to harken back to trying to make back to any progression with gay rights. So
certainly on that, I don't know what he's harkening back to, because he seems to think that, you know, our country was founded on Christian values and things like that. And I don't know what I mean. Certainly some of our initial colonists, as I maybe have said in a previous episode, were definitely in favor of religion. But once we incorporated as a nation, as a country, like we have the First Amendment for a very specific reason. And that was negotiated and bargained for amongst all of the founders.
And it's not a coincidence that it's number one in their list of things we'd better amend about.
know, right.
Yeah. They felt it was pretty darn important.
So just some of the little gems from Mr. Moore over here. I wish we could have less of this than more. But he had actually, in a ruling in 2002, when he was a justice, had said the homosexual conduct of a parent creates a strong presumption of unfitness that alone is sufficient justification for denying that parent custody of his or her own children or prohibiting the adoption of the children of the other.
It's a very strong assertion, with no backing whatsoever.
Right. I'm kind of in the same boat on this one. I think I've heard a lot of what Roy Moore has to say. Some of it from Roy Moore, some of it from a movement that's been around pretty much as long as, well, as long as anyone can remember. There have been people who are like, we hate the gays for, you know, no actual empirically identifiable reason.
Are you saying the Bible's not empirical?
Yes.
How dare you?
Imperial, perhaps, but not empirical.
So it actually gets worse than that, of him just saying that, you know, being gay alone is justification that you're unfit to be a parent and we can take away your kids just because you're gay, or we can deny you the ability to adopt your partner's children because, you know, you are gay. He actually goes even further in other rulings to have said that being gay is and has been considered abhorrent, immoral, detestable, a crime against nature, and a violation of the laws of nature and of nature's God upon which this nation and our laws are predicated.
I love the concept that, like, he's using the nature's God concept because, I mean, that's almost like kind of like a deistic concept of a god.
Which is similar to what a lot of the founders had held, right, in terms of their personal beliefs. But
when they don't have grounds, that's just what they try and go back to, is like nature's God. So they try and assert that nature is a thing, but there's a God over it.
Right. I've always found the argument that it's unnatural to be just sort of silly. That,
yeah.
How many species have we actually seen having same-sex behaviors together, you know, either copulatory or romantic long-term partnerships in different species all around?
Recent counts, more than 600.
Okay.
However, as the internet is apt to point out, homophobia and that sort of bigotry only exist in one species.
Is that really the case, or is that just a really, really nice talking point? Like, have we actually seen, like, if you have two penguins, so, like, Tango Makes Three is actually, you know, a really sweet storybook about two male penguins that wanted to raise a chick together and had long-term partnered and, you know, and had become their long-term mates, right, to parent a chick. Now, have we seen actually some bullying of other of the same species to, you know, different same-sex parenting or couples or things like that? Like, do we see penguins pecking at each other, pecking at little Tango's, you know, Tango's little daddies, right? His little penguin dads?
Sure. Well, I think the difficulty there is you'll have to guess motivation.
Okay.
Because, you know, a penguin may be capable of hate speech in their own language, but it's not a language that we can decipher.
So, and we can't really tell if they're stealing all the good food access places because right. it's two dads raising a penguin chick, or whether it's food is scarce.
Right. I mean, depending on the species, many penguins are somewhat cooperative parents. Many penguins are very territorial parents. And so, can we say that the couple of penguins next door is pecking these two males that are mated and raising a chick because they are two males that are mated or raising a chick, or because one of their pebbles rolled a little bit too close to their sort of imaginary property line? It's not really something that you can parse out in an empirical way.
Okay. I do want to mention also we are heading right into Banned and Challenged Books Week, and Tango Makes Three is a lovely picture book on Tango, the little penguin with his dad penguins, which comes up very, very often on challenged books because it teaches the homosexual agenda to little children through pictures and animals.
The homosexual agenda to meet somebody and be good parents together.
Yeah.
Terrifying.
How dare they have equal rights?
Right.
Right. One of the things that was really puzzling to me is Roy Moore's obsession with, you know, nature's God and upon which this nation and our laws are predicated. So our laws are apparently predicated on nature's God or on the laws of nature. Okay. So I didn't know that we have a pro-gravity law. I didn't know that our laws were predicated on nature. I'm not sure about that. But in a really recent interview from this summer, he actually had said that there are communities under Sharia law right now in our country, up in Illinois, Christian communities. I don't know if they may be Muslim communities, but Sharia law is a little different from American law. It is founded on religious concepts.
But he's trying to define his law as Christian, as like a religious concept. I mean, what?
So, also, I want to know what part of Illinois is under Sharia law, especially when he says Christian communities under Sharia law.
It's obviously where Obama's from.
Naturally.
Well, the Obama thing, you're not too far off, Josh, because he actually had said that his personal belief was that Obama wasn't a natural born citizen. He later then said, well, it's not, you know, it's kind of too late to do anything about it because Obama had at that time been sworn in to be president. But he also, you know, has his own feelings on, you know, reality and his tendency to ignore long form birth certificates.
Right. And Supreme Court justices.
Yeah. The Supreme Court justice, ruling the Obergefell v. Hodges that actually legalized marriage equality throughout all 50 states, you know, struck down any of these state laws saying two people of the same gender can't get married. He not only defied that as Supreme Court justice in Alabama, but he actually wrote to all 50 governors saying, you must defy this, and I urge you to continue denying same-sex marriage licenses. And, oh, by the way, let's get a constitutional convention going so that we can create a constitutional amendment to outlaw same-sex marriage. Yeah, he totally failed at that attempt. But he would have been in front of the same judicial ethics panel to get him yanked then, too.
Right.
This guy just really doesn't give up. He's saying, okay, so Sharia law was founded on religious concepts as opposed to American law, but he also says that American law is based on nature's God and things that consider being gay to be detestable, abhorrent crimes against nature. I think he's a little mixed up.
I think if you constantly hold contradictory positions, you can be assured that at least one of them is right at some point.
Oh, is this the broken clock theory?
I think maybe it is.
Okay.
That maybe...
Every minute is 4 p.m., and I just insist at all times that
it's 4
p.m.,
and once in a while, it's actually 4 p.m.
And also, he's sadly been very successful in his detestable actions. Basically, so he's been deposed as a judge twice, and now he's going to probably fail upwards as a senator now.
Yeah, that failing upwards for someone that's just horrid and vile in their beliefs against others. You know, when you're horrible and vile in your beliefs and you keep it to yourself, you know, most of the time you're hurting a very small pool of folks in your immediate vicinity. But when someone has power like that, it's very troubling. It's very troubling. And I'm interested to see, you know, you brought it to my attention that what's his opponent's name? Doug Jones?
Doug Jones.
So he was the attorney general, the person who kind of is responsible for looking at the laws and then perhaps saying, hey, you know, there's people in our state that are violating our laws. you know, going straight up against, you know, Violator in Chief, you know, for this, you know, I will say also, Josh, he was not deposed of his seat twice. The second time he just dropped out in order to pursue his Senate seat before they actually said, oh, we're kicking you off a second time.
Okay, I wasn't aware of that.
So, yeah, he withdrew, you know, in April so that he could start running his Senate candidacy. But I do want to go back to this thing. You had thought that Trump perhaps had backed his opponent, Luther Strange, merely because Strange is a tall dude, right?
Yeah. So Trump has shown an affinity towards tall people because he views them as powerful.
Okay.
And so that was a very strong deciding factor, I believe.
I guess that's the laws of nature. That's your reptilian brain saying, you are big. That must mean you are powerful and scary. I want big, scary, powerful people on my team.
It doesn't seem like it, but actually Trump isn't that short either. He's a pretty tall guy.
Is that why he's also so sensitive about the hands comments? He doesn't want any bit of him to be seen as tiny? I don't know.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't Obama quite tall?
You're forgetting one important fact, though.
Yeah, I am. Nobody wants to say it out loud.
Not to mention.
So the things of which we won't mention, we'll go back to Trump for a minute. And that's, I guess this gets into our best words. Just after it was announced that Roy Moore had beaten opponent Luther Strange in the Alabama Senate primary, Donald Trump deleted a series of tweets that he'd made in support of the losing candidate. ProPublica group has archived those endorsements, and the group Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, or CREW, brought suit against Trump's administration earlier for deleting tweets, alleging that Trump was destroying official presidential records and not private speech. Trump's office also maintains that tweets issued from the @RealDonaldTrump account are indeed official presidential statements. This is very interesting. This is kind of beyond just his endorsement of a losing candidate and, oh, I don't want to be seen as endorsing the losing candidate because that might transfer loser dumb to me, because we all know that he's obsessed with losers. It's one of his favorite insults, right? Horrible, horrible, huge losers, right? That's some of the best words that he can muster.
He also understands that we have a short memory. So if you delete the record, sure, we can fact correct after the fact, but if any of his fans actually look at it, now that they're deleted, they're not going to search any further than that.
So it's actually kind of troubling because when we had heard about Namibia, right, being printed in the official White House transcript as Namibia, despite purporting to be an official transcript of words uttered by Trump, you know, during this particular meet and greet dinner with some African leaders, he had said Nambia, yet the White House official transcript quoted him as having said Namibia. So between that, these little corrections that sort of appear there without any notation of them being corrections, plus the deletions of things, seems to be somewhat troubling in terms of wanting to have accuracy, wanting to be based in evidence. It has. I think troubling implications for those who want to be evidence-based, those who want to be legal scholars, and those who want to have an accurate representation of history.
Yeah, his speech in Charlottesville is another prime example of that, because when he talked about it afterwards, he deletes the many sides portion of it and said that he said nothing wrong. He actually tried to real-time correct his,
I had forgotten about that when he kept saying, why is everyone yelling at me for having said bad things? And he would repeat all the talking points except for that. You know, some of them are, you know, both sides being poorly behaved, right? So this actually led me to go looking into what actually has to be preserved in terms of presidential record and things like that. So the Presidential Records Act was only passed in 1978. So it's pretty recent, surprisingly.
That was a response to Richard Nixon?
Yes, it was exactly a response to Watergate. And it actually left archiving all records with the responsibility of the president. And the most common way of doing that is through the National Archives. So that actually seems a little bit of like maybe this wasn't thought out exactly well. If you want to have presidential records being, you know, preserved, yet the responsibility is with the person who you're trying to keep accountable, I don't really know if that bodes very well.
Well, I think in this case, it gives a pretty clear outline for what was done, how it was wrong, and whose responsibility it is. So that if there was any, you know, any sort of disciplinary action to be taken by well, by the rest of the
by
the rest of the country, that it would be pretty clear that, you know, what the violation was, why it was a violation, and precisely who is responsible, in this case the president, for deleting articles of presidential record.
So there's other things that are really weird, though, that you know, Trump actually does claim to the Columbia Journalism Review that the administration is indeed backing up all of the tweets, even the deleted ones. But there's not really any evidence of where that's happening because the National Archives aren't actually involved. So we don't know whether that's happening or not. And we have different watchdog groups and ProPublica, you know, groups like that, that are actually making these archives of them, because there's a lot of people that don't trust the administration to be doing that. And the final little thing was Trump actually then issuing some tweets after he had deleted his support of Luther Strange. He did tweet, "In analyzing the Alabama primary race, fake news," which of course is in all caps, "always fails to mention that the candidate that Trump endorsed went up many points after endorsement." So he's saying, okay, well, the reality is Luther Strange lost by about 10 percentage points, I think it was, at the last my last check. But Trump is saying, hey, what you forgot to mention is that after I endorsed him, he went up many, many, many points. Which isn't a great thing in your favor, sir, if you, your candidate, your favored candidate, still lost by 10%, right?
If he went up by many points and still lost by 10%.
You were backing a losing horse to begin with,
and,
sir.
And what is many in this context? Is this like a
number greater than two?
Accounting problem? Yes. One, two, many.
Exactly. Yes. I'm with that. Man, I you know what? I think I'm really glad for organizations like ProPublica and Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington that, you know, 40, 50 years after big, you know, presidential kind of scandals like Watergate, we can say, hey, there's a need for this, even so. And if I were in a leadership position, I would want to have groups that are checking me, holding me accountable, because I would be a steward of the nation. I would be a steward of that organization, you know, in which case would be the country. So I'm glad for that. But I can go on to some tweets that Trump has not yet deleted, and that has to do with Hurricane Maria. You guys ready for this one?
All right, here we go.
A little bit back to not so buenas tardes. Donald Trump hit back against San Juan, Puerto Rico's Mayor Carmen Yulín Cruz's rallying cry for assistance to the island, with tweets critical of her leadership, accusing her of being unable to get their workers to help, and suggesting that Yulín Cruz was told by the Democrats that you must be nasty to Trump. Trump's social media director Dan Scavino even retweeted a year-old post of the mayor's in which she supported then-candidate Clinton. Scavino used it to characterize Yulín Cruz as a Trump hater and the perfect example of an opportunistic politician. Yulín Cruz passionately disagreed with Homeland Security Secretary Elaine Duke's assessment of Hurricane Maria response as a, quote, good news story, countering that this is a people are dying story. She also noted that while she is, quote, just a little mayor from the capital of the city of the capital city of San Juan, three-star General Jeffrey Buchanan, who's now been put in charge of hurricane, you know, response and relief, he is telling the world that right now he does not have the appropriate means and tools to take care of the situation. Oh, man, this is a mess, guys. Have you guys been following this at all?
Yeah, no, it's absolutely terrible. I mean, Puerto Rico was absolutely devastated by these two hurricanes that have hit them. And I mean, the hurricane season is not over. So,
you know, I know that one of Foundation Beyond Belief's biggest payouts in terms of charity fundraising through secular means was in response to Hurricane Harvey. And that's amazing. That's, you know, right around $100,000 that's been, you know, able to go to hurricane relief. I actually took a mapping application and I looked at the country, you know, the country state of territory of Puerto Rico, and I mapped it over the Houston area. And Puerto Rico has about 3.5 million people, 3.4 million people in it. A lot of it is mountainous and rainforest and things like that. But it has about 3.5 million people. And you take the area, the geographic area of Puerto Rico, which has no running water, limited electricity by generators only, with limited access to diesel fuel to keep the generators going, and limited communications in terms of cell phone coverage. You overlay that on the Houston area, it stretches all the way from western Houston to Beaumont. And that whole area, putting that in perspective of that whole area having, you know, had rapt attention in terms of the horrible and awful flooding that was happening and people being told to evacuate and yet not having an evacuation route to go, people being told to shelter in place during tornadoes. It was awful. It was terrifying. It was scary. And so many people's livelihoods, you know, were cut off that way. But floodwaters did recede. We have in Puerto Rico, the area that is about the same size that was affected by Hurricane Harvey in the greater Houston metroplex, with 80% of the agriculture destroyed, with still no running water. And it seems like we could have also the secular community say, hey, these are Americans or these are people, and we need to also mobilize for assistance and fundraising because there's going to be a lot of need there.
Yeah, I don't even think Trump understood the fact that these were American citizens up until recently.
Oh, my God. So I'll go back to high school for just a minute again, right? So we have in the beginning, after we do our, you know, buenos dias and buenas tardes, we go right into geography unit of where is Spanish spoken. And there's, you know, 22 majority Spanish speaking countries around the world. Never have I felt so keenly the need, the urgency to teach where Puerto Rico is on a map. Exactly in what great, great oceans. Surrounded by water,
right.
Puerto Rico can be found. Right,
that's right. That's right. It's in the big ocean.
It's a big ocean.
All that big water.
Surrounded by water. It's
nothing for thousands of miles.
I mean, like as opposed to an island in the middle of a continent. I don't. Yeah. So I don't know that Trump could locate Puerto Rico on a map, and I don't know that he could actually specify which ocean Puerto Rico was in. But damn it, my students, my high school freshmen can definitely now point to Puerto Rico on a map and see where it is and exactly which ocean and which, you know, bodies of water it is near and where the hurricanes, came through and things like that.
I'm waiting for him to assert that this hurricane is going to be good for tourism for Puerto Rico, just like Guam.
What? He said that a typhoon in Guam was good for tourism?
No, actually, the threat of nuclear annihilation for Guam was good for tourism for.
Oh my goodness. And Josh, you bring us right next to our final best words. And oh man, this is, and then I'm done. I'm done with any more best words because man, I am just, I have to just go teach now where Guam is on a map. But North Korean Foreign Minister Ri Yong-ho has accused Donald Trump of declaring war after Trump tweeted that the insular nation might not be around much longer. Minister Ri contended that the declaration gives the regime the right to shoot down U.S. bombers even if they are outside North Korean airspace. White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders said it was absurd to interpret Trump's tweet as such, saying that the U.S. has not declared war in North Korea. So not only are they threatening Guam, they can also shoot down U.S. bombers, things like that. And Trump,
well, they could try.
Trump just thinks this is just good for tourism?
Well, tourists don't usually arrive by bomber.
So they're not going to get shot down.
I think he just thinks that Guam, nobody knew where Guam was at until it started becoming under attack. And now he thinks that Guam is now on the map because of that.
Well, I'm not sure exactly whether bombing is going to be good for tourism or not. I would say probably a no, unfortunately, or fortunately, as we may see. This is Ask an Atheist, 844 Skeptic. We're going to be back after the break with a little update from Sam, actually. But in the meantime, you can email us questions at askanatheist.tv. Give us a voicemail at 844-SKEPTIC. We'll be back after the break.
Okay, can you say Radio Tacoma?
Radio Katoma.
Tacoma.
Tacoma.
K-T-A-H-L-P. 101.9 FM.
You are listening to KTAHLP 101.9 FM, Radio Tacoma, operating under a construction permit. If you'd like to help us out or learn more, go to radiotacoma.org. Specifically, if you're hearing this, we'd love to hear where you are and how you found this.
Welcome back to Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC. I'm Becky, and with me in the studio are Josh and Dan, and I would like to invite you to go to askanatheist.tv and contribute to Peggy's challenge. It's the challenge by our listener Peggy from Kent to help us keep the lights on. We're bit a down in contributions that help us cover our hosting costs and our equipment upgrade costs and things like that. So, you know, throw in a little bit of change there. And separately, Sam has a Patreon that's been helping with some Ask an Atheist adjacent activities. There's some really cool things on the horizon. Again, thanks to Justin, Megan, and Jesse for becoming Sam's newest patrons this quarter. You can go to patreon.com/Sam Mulvey. And Dan, I am so happy to have you back in the studio because it's been a little long time since we've had anything for science.
Yeah, it's been since February, actually.
Really? Yeah. Has it? You went back and checked. And
yeah, we had a major case of life complications, what with house hunting and buying a house and moving and everything that happened over the summer.
You're doing lots of
and sciencing. Yes, sciencing is my job, and so I've been doing a little bit less recreational sciencing. But yeah,
so you've got some science for us today. What's it about?
I do. Today's for science is about synanthropes. So synanthropes are the plants and animals that actually prosper when they share their environment with humans. As humans take over more and more land for our farms, cities, roadways, and other developments, many species of living things are dispossessed of their homes, driven away, or even driven to extinction. But a select few benefit tremendously from human encroachment, and they're the synanthropes. The word synanthrope has its origins in the Greek language. Syn means together or along with, and anthro means man. Now, there's a distinction to be made here, however. In general terms, synanthropes happen by accident, not by our deliberate actions. Certainly, we raise large populations of cows, pigs, sheep, corn, apples, and plenty of other living things, but they're not really synanthropes. However, the field mice that eat that corn, and even the fireweed that grows where the pigs have rooted up the ground, are synanthropes. And most of them are what we think of as edge organisms. That is, they are plants and animals that rely on a boundary between ecosystems or a natural disaster in order to thrive. For example, one of my favorites, the American crow, or Corvus brachyrhynchus, they're very seldom found in deep forests, where they're kind of easily outcompeted by more specialized birds. Crows are generalist and omnivores, and they can and do eat just about anything that they can swallow. And their lifestyle relies on scanning the margins of forests, beaches, and fields, and finding the things that stick out from the landscape. For example, a lone insect or a cluster of brightly colored berries. Human activities, from building cities to clearing paths for railroads, create new margins and extend old ones, increasing good crow habitat and concordantly increasing their overall population size. Gray squirrels, coyotes, raccoons, and pigeons, the city pigeons you may be familiar with are actually rock doves, they're also edge creatures and benefit when human developments are nearby. But it's not just animals. Many species of plants also flourish under our clumsy land management practices. Synanthropic plants that are native to the area are what we call apophytes, and some apophytes you might be familiar with in the Pacific Northwest are the aforementioned fireweed, snowberries, cattails, red alder trees. Each of these plants are among the first to come up after a natural disaster, like a flood, a fire, or a landslide. They've evolved to fill that niche. Naturally, when humans disturb a forested area, these opportunistic apophytes take advantage of the opening, so as we expand our range, we expand theirs too. But not all synanthropes are native species. Anthrophytes are plants from other parts of the world that humans have intentionally or accidentally brought over and are able to exploit the changes we've made to our environment. Some examples of anthrophytes are dandelions, spearleaf plantains, wall lettuce, barberry, locust trees, and escaped crops like Himalayan blackberry. Which brings us to an interesting problem. Here in the Pacific Northwest, we have a real conundrum with that particular plant. Himalayan blackberry has grown out of control around our cities, suburbs, yards, freeways, railroad tracks, and even on the roofs of our buildings. This thorny invasive produces huge amounts of delicious berries, but it also has a tendency to loosen soil and destabilize slopes, thus expanding its own habitat by creating more edge areas of disturbed land. Couple that with our native friend, the crow, and we have an even bigger problem. The crows, just like us, love those delicious blackberries and spread their seeds over great distances, often flying 40 miles or more in a single day. The crows spread the blackberries, which creates more edge environments for the berries to thrive, which in turn are food for the crows and other synanthropic birds, which also thrive, and continue to spread the berries even further, exacerbating the problem on a tremendous scale. In Western Washington, this feedback loop is absolutely out of control, and it's not clear whether the problem can be solved at all, let alone how to go about doing so. So sometimes synanthropes, both native and introduced, can have some very serious consequences when their adaptations are combined. Now, Here's the part that stings. What adaptations make an organism a synanthrope? None of them evolved to withstand industrial Western civilization. It hasn't been going on long enough. That's not the real strategy at play. What they're evolved for is the ability to withstand or even succeed in the aftermath of a natural disaster. Synanthropes might just be the most damning judgment nature can make about the way we affect our environments. Floods, fires, landslides, volcanic eruptions, and modern humans. We can and should do better. With our amazing intellects, technology, cooperation, and relentless drive to understand and improve, we can change who and what we are. We don't have to be a natural disaster. We can also be a force of restoration.
Thank you, Dan. If you've got a question for Dan that you want him to explain in terms of anything that's related to science, especially biology and ecology, go to questions@askanatheist.tv and submit your question. Dan, I think that there's something that's really key here in terms of looking at synanthropes, those organisms that live alongside humankind. And I actually kind of want to relate it to humanism for a minute. One of the very strange criticisms I've gotten from people that are unfamiliar with secular humanism or maybe less well-read in it is they hear the word human in humanism and they say, well, I'm not a humanist because I'm all for animal rights and I'm all for taking care of our environment, and humanists are speciesists. This is a real criticism that some people, even within the secular and atheistic and free thinking community, get. Pete Singer, who actually wrote a piece for Free Inquiry back in 2004, that says that humanists, it's very curious that humanists on the whole have been unable to free themselves from one of the most central of the Christian dogmas, and that's the prejudice of speciesism. But what you've demonstrated here in terms of your own take on this phenomenon of synanthropes is actually that editorial perspective of not saying, hey, humans are the best. Humans do have the ingenuity to create these environments where synanthropes thrive, but then also have the ingenuity to repair places where synanthropes and other organisms may be very much in peril. And I think that that's a really important thing to note for people that are just investigating humanism for the first time and they see that human part of it and think, oh, well, I'm not a humanist because I don't think that humans are the best. You know, and it's a weird kind of position to put yourself in to think about, you know, well, if I'm a Christian, I think Christ is at the top of the ladder. And, you know, if I'm a Jew, I think Yahweh is at the top of the ladder. And if I'm a humanist, I must think that humans are at the top of the ladder of bestness. And it really goes to show that most humanists are very much aware of and invested in issues of our environment.
Right. This is actually kind of a, I think it's sort of an accusation, a lot like what I hear from, well, actually both men and women. Oh, I'm not a feminist because I don't think that women should be in charge of everything and rule with an iron fist. Like, oh no, that's not actually at all what it's about. I guess you might assert that if you'd only ever heard the word and never actually seen what people do within the humanism movement or within the feminism movement. But I can say as one example, as this humanist, I like humans a lot. I think that not because we're great, but because we're capable. We're capable of change. We're capable of big effects. When we do horrible things, we can do really horrible things. When we do great things, we can do really great things. But the thing that kind of makes humans special is that we have the ability to make tremendous changes, and we have the ability to think about tremendous changes, and we have the ability to decide whether something is good or bad. And I understand enough ecology to know that human beings, in our current technological state, we cannot survive without a healthy planet. We can't. There will be no food. There will be no air.
Now, we as a species in our current technological state?
I mean we as a species, as our current technological state.
If our current technological state had a lot of species, a lot of our species that were just to die off, but a very select few were to populate in a different planet or have a small population on our current planet that was sustainable, right, and sustained by, you know, our crops, you think even that horrible scenario from sci-fi dystopic, you know, themes also is not possible.
Right.
Interesting.
We cannot survive with the kind of destruction that we're doing. We cannot survive with the practices that we have with our with the way we're running our industry. Ecology is a very complex topic, but when it comes down to simple things, we know that we are causing ocean acidification very rapidly, meaning there isn't a lot of time for organisms that have survived several longer scale, slower warming and acidification events. They don't have time to get selected out and propagate like they did during, say, the KT extinction event. Right now, this is happening too fast. And most people aren't aware of this, but if our listeners would take a deep breath right now, about 51% of that oxygen came from phytoplankton, microscopic plants or plant-like organisms living in the ocean. Most of the air we breathe isn't coming from land plants. So when we're talking about, you know, we've got to plant more trees and we've got to save the trees, that's absolutely true. But when we have something on the horizon that planting trees doesn't do a whole lot about, like ocean acidification caused by CO2 pollution, we're basically strangling ourselves. We have a continuous drop in the pH of ocean seawater. And there is a point where we're not going to be able to get back from that.
So it's a lot of reflective kind of things to be looking at there.
Right.
In terms of how, as humanists, you can actually, without elevating humans to the top of, you know, any kind of, you know, top echelon of any kind of hierarchy of anything, you can also say, well, we are invested in the survival of humans and the flourishing of humans.
Absolutely.
But in order to keep flourishing, we gotta actually preserve a lot of the other things and help them flourish too.
Absolutely. Yeah. Like I said, I like humans. I think we're great. And I want there to be humans for a long, long time. As far as I know, as anyone knows, we're the only intelligent life in the universe. And Earth may be the only life in the universe. It's certainly the only one that we have any proof of. And if that's the case, I think life and humans and intelligence is a pretty special thing. And I'd like to see it stick around for as long as possible. And that's my motivation as a humanist environmentalist.
Cool, cool. Can I switch gears just a little bit to the silly end of things? Because I love this word synanthrope, and I'm teaching things like synonyms, and I like seeing, you know, words broken apart and seeing there. But I also hear what words sound like. And every time I've been hearing this word synanthrope, and anyone who has attended a Jewish wedding or a Jewish bar mitzvah might be familiar with this phrase. There is a phrase called siman tov. And to me, just synanthrope just reminds me of this word siman tov. And there's this like really wonderful party song that I kind of played for you guys beforehand of siman tov u'mazel tov. And it's just it's that joyous time when you're bouncing the bride and groom up on chairs, on shoulders, or the bar mitzvah kid up on the shoulder. And it's just, I always hear it in my head and it's funny. And it brings me actually to another kind of place in the world and some different kind of reflection, and that is to Israel. Because this past weekend was actually Yom Kippur, which is the Jewish Day of Atonement. And we as atheists, you know, obviously we're not going to be observing the Day of Atonement in the Jewish way that says, oh, God is writing your name in the book of whether you're going to stay alive for this year or whether he's going to kill you by some horrible thing this year, right? That's kind of a scary image that I went through as a kid, right? God is inscribing your name. Is it going to be in the book of life? Or is God going to inscribe your name in the, you know, who will die by fire this year? Who will die by starvation and hunger? Who will die by terrible accidents? It's a real thing. Josh, you're giving me an eyebrow.
Sounds more evil than Santa Claus.
Yeah, it's more than just getting a lump of coal. It's like, what are you going to really get in the end?
When he sticks Krampus on you.
Yeah, it's the big kid version of Santa Claus bringing you toys or the Krampus, you know, stealing all the badly behaved kids. It's the big kid version of that where your entire community has to atone and mourn together to say, is God going to be your Santa Claus and bring you abundance this year? Or is God going to be the person that wipes you from the face of the earth?
What's even worse than that, though? I mean, that's saying if you die within that year, you deserved it.
Yes, it is.
Wow.
It is.
That is
very,
whoa.
It's loaded
with some very
with,
advanced technology and victim blaming.
it's a very different kind of atonement process. It's also very communal because at that time you confess the sins from the community as well. As if, you know, if someone has sinned in this particular way, it is as if we have all sinned in this particular way. You know, we're responsible for the communal behavior of all of us within our in-group, which can be very useful for controlling behavior, right, of a particular group. It for a lot of people, is also a time of reflection to say, how can I help others be better and lift up others to be more in line with, like, what is ethical behavior? But overall, it sounds really kind of freaky, right? But
yeah, absolutely.
Israel, filled with Jews, right? And not all of them are religious. So during this Yom Kippur time, everything shuts down. But what do all the secular folks in Israel have to do? Well, the Israeli paramedic and ambulance service, Magen David Adom, treated more than 2,000 individuals during the 25-hour Yom Kippur observance. Around 228 people required treatment for dehydration and fainting related to religious fasting, but many injuries involved cyclists, skateboarders, and rollerbladers. The observance that marks the Jewish Day of Atonement typically sees secular masses taking advantage of empty roadways and a countrywide cessation of business. So, here we are, right, in the Pacific Northwest. If you can just imagine all of I-5 just shutting down, there's no one on the freeways whatsoever because no one drives any cars. What do you want to do if you're an outdoor enthusiast, of which many Israelis are, and you got better weather there? What are you going to do? Have a big old bike parade down I-5.
Yeah, why not?
Oh, no, absolutely. That sounds like fun. And can we arrange that to happen here?
I don't know.
All the Christians to stop working so we can go out and play?
Well, it would mean that we would actually have a cessation of all government business and all vehicle traffic based on religious grounds. So I'm not going to propose that at all because I wouldn't want that kind of thing happening here.
What happens if you call the cops during Yom Kippur?
There are secular individuals, just like the ambulance drivers, there are secular individuals that, you know, elect to work on those particular days. So you still have, you know, police and fire and emergency response service going on. And even those who are religiously observant sometimes will prioritize public safety over religious observance because Talmudic interpretation says prioritize the preservation of human life and health over your need to fulfill a particular commandment.
That's fairly humanistic as well, isn't it?
It is. It's a pretty good one. So, like, you know, while there's some things that within my, you know, the faith of my birth, right, of my heritage, were definitely kind of creepy and controlling, there's also these loopholes for, no, really, we still want people to, like, be alive. We don't want you to prioritize a principle over the life of someone. So don't try and observe your required fasting and prayer and prayer requirements over the pregnant lady that's also trying to fast and happen to faint, right? And you get all these kinds of dispensations. So actually, if you're pregnant or if you're infirmed, you're not really supposed to do a true fast, and you can, you know, drink liquids and all the kinds of things. So I just really like the idea of, you know, I-5 completely clear of all vehicles. And kind of, I don't know what it was like for you guys the week after 9/11 in 2001, when there was no air traffic. Did you guys live here?
I was in South Korea.
Okay. I was here.
So yeah. You had air traffic actually going on, right, Josh?
No, it was. I think it was pretty much closed down because I was on a military base. I mean, we were on complete lockdown.
Ah, okay. So it must have had this eerie quiet without, or were there a lot of military planes being mobilized at that time?
Not where I was at.
Okay.
Where I was located at, we didn't have aircraft.
So you were here though, Dan.
I was here, yeah, and I was working very long hours at the time, actually running a Liberty boat for the carrier Abraham Lincoln.
I think,
and
you
so
have,
I was kind of on and off the military base all day as well, and out on the open water while we were moving our sailors from one base to another. It was actually very quiet and very still, but as soon as we got to the base, there was a tremendous amount of military plane activity. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
But it's strange when the only engines that you're hearing, especially if you're sort of attuned to the differences in airplane engines or aircraft engines, I should say, when the only engines you're hearing are, you know, FA-18 Super Hornets that you can hear for a ridiculously long distance, and that's all you hear screaming by when you're accustomed to the sound of, you know, commercial jetliners, and you're accustomed to the sound of Cessnas, and we have a lot of seaplane traffic in this part. It's really bizarre to just hear that one thing.
Well, I think if we ever had a cessation of all work activity and traffic, I think that we might know exactly what we're doing with ourselves on I-5, perhaps rollerblading, perhaps
jet planes,
bicycling, all sorts of things. This is Ask an Atheist. Stay tuned. We'll be back after the break.
Okay, can you say Radio Tacoma? say Radio Tacoma?
Radio Tacoma.
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 KTAHLP 101.9 FM.
You are listening to KTAHLP 101.9 FM, Radio Tacoma, operating under a construction permit. If you'd like to help us out or learn more, go to radiotacoma.org. Specifically, if you're hearing this, we'd love to hear where you are and how you found this. Now, back to the testing.
Welcome back to Ask an Atheist. 844 Skeptic. We've got a little commentary from our very own host, producer, and creator, Sam. He is still on vacation, but we'll hear what he might have to say about some of the things that have been going on in his absence.
So I wondered how long it would take me to want to issue a correction to something said on my own show while I'm on vacation. And turns out the answer is about a month. This is Sam. I'm currently up the mountain. Of course I brought some recording gear with me. Are you kidding? I have a whole bunch of stuff splayed out on this desk here. And it was about, oh man, it was not this week's episode, but the week before. What was that episode called? It was Death Planet versus Juggalos versus Mary Tyler Moore. Great episode. Great show all around. In fact, honestly, I think the show might be doing a little bit better without me than with me these days. Might it have something to do with our stunning new host and new producers? I don't know. I'll leave that up to you to find out. Anyway, specifically about Korea and language and the word doddered. I was familiar with the word doddered because I like throwing in archaic language and, you know, used to read a dictionary for fun, that sort of thing. But I also know a little bit about the Korean language because I wanted to learn it at one point. And in fact, I'll probably get back on that one of these days. But one of the interesting things is the diversion between the language in North Korea and South Korea. And there's been a significant shift in Korean, North versus South, where there's actually been more change in the South Korean variant and a lot of loan words from American English. There's been not a huge change in orthography, but a lot of change in vocabulary, a lot of loan words, some shift in, construction of sentences and stuff like that, where thanks to sort of the centralization of North Korea, there hasn't been quite as much change, and all of their words are actually Russian loan words, or specifically Stalinist Russia loan words. What apparently it sounds like to a South Korean when speaking to a North Korean is, you know, some guy comes up and starts calling you Tovarish and complaining about laudanum addiction, which explains why a translator might use a word like doddered. Beyond that, I honestly, it sounded a little bit like Becky was positively comparing Kim Jong-un to Trump, and that my mind staggered a little bit. In fact, if there were one world leader who I would rate Trump positively against, it would be the post-Stalinist leader of a micro fairy tale nation where his father was a living god and, you know, he's basically a king. I would not be a fan of that, I guess is how I would put it. That's basically all I need to say. Other than that, man, these guys are doing really good. Not much of a complaint, because I don't actually think Becky was doing that, but I was, you know, driving in my truck listening to that. I'm like, it's a little bit worse when it's your own show. Actually, I scream a lot less when it's my own show. Maybe it's because I personally know the people involved. Who knows? Not necessarily atheism related, but I noticed that Amazon, released a whole bunch of new products, including the Echo Spot, which, okay, I don't know if anybody else has noticed this because I'm not really paying attention to the media. I'm just reading, this blog that I check for stuff. It's apparently an alarm clock with a camera pointed at your bed. You know, that's the last thing I really want. Or really the last thing that anybody should really want. A multi-billion dollar corporation with questionable human resources practices watching us.
Shazbot.
Now, I realize that rich people tend to have fairly attenuated sexual tastes, but this seems a little bit much. I don't know. These cloud-hosted cameras and microphones coming into the house. I don't like it. I don't like it at all. But now a camera pointed at my bed watching me sleep and, well, do other things just seems a bridge too far. And I wonder if anybody else notices this. It just seems like, oh, Amazon's making a new home thing. It's great. And between you and me, these devices will not be allowed in my home or used in my home until they're self-hosted, until they require no connection to Amazon, no connection to Google, and that's it. Like, that's really, that's what I would need to use them. Otherwise, I will happily and steadfastly remain a old fogey of the early 21st century where I actually needed to to address a device directly in order to get access to the outside world. Well, if you need any more proof that I'm hanging out up on a mountain, I'm going a little bit loopy and complaining about how the machine is taking away our privacy. I don't know what you need more than that. Feeling a little out of practice. Maybe I need to, I don't know, spar? Is there sparring with a microphone? Well, not sparring with a microphone. I imagine that would be expensive. Well, that's all I've got for the podcast. If you want to hear more, including a hangover story and what it is I'm doing up on the mountain, you can check out my Patreon. Anyway, check you guys later.
So thanks, Sam. And yeah, Sam's Patreon can be found at patreon.com/SamMulvey. Dan, Josh, you guys had some quizzical sort of reactions to this idea of an alarm clock with a camera pointed at your bed. This is not like a video screen where you can watch things from your bed. This is the alarm clock watching you in Soviet bedroom. Alarm clock watches you. So what was your sort of quizzical pushback against this?
Well, my stance is that I can't trust Amazon not to be hacked. And I believe Dan.
My stance is I just don't trust a camera pointed at my bed that's accessible to anybody, whether it is a corporation that wants to know exactly what kinds of things they can target advertising towards me, or somebody who's gotten into their system and is able to hack the clock. I'm just not a fan. You know, honestly, I don't really like cameras pointed at me ever unless my specific goal is to be on camera at the time.
So it's similar, you would say, to the smart TVs that listen to your voice activation, or the dolls that are interactive with kids that, you know, if you give, you know, kid input, it sort of talks back to help their language development and things like that. Those are all those cloud hosted devices where people can access your input, whether it be visual through a camera or audio for a microphone. And so, like Sam, you guys are on that same page of nope, not in my house?
Yeah, I think I am. And I'm pretty okay with the camera on my laptop. I'm not really the kind of person who like
I got the sticker over mine, but you know.
You know what? I'm not really worried about people seeing what I do on my computer. I'm just not. But when I'm asleep or in my bed, I just don't want a camera pointed at me. I think that's pretty reasonable.
Yeah, I could definitely imagine many scenarios where that's definitely not. I mean, especially like performance anxiety. I mean, you're on camera at all times. I mean, it's got to come in at some point.
So someone's going to criticize my snoring technique. Is that what you're saying? Yeah.
Yes.
That's sure. What you're saying.
Family friendly.
So your snoring technique, man, that girl needs a CPAP. I don't know what's going on. So, but you have Sam's comments about me possibly maybe elevating the linguistic aptitude of a terrible North Korean dictator in esteem above our terrible elected leader. And I would want to say for the record that I do not hold any terrible North Korean dictator in any kind of esteem above Donald Trump, as much as I will say that Donald Trump has things that go against things from a humanistic, ethical, you know, value, and from a reality-based, rational value, you know, stance. I would feel similarly about the leader of North Korea. So I do wanna set that record straight. And I think that it was a little bit of, you know, tongue-in-cheek teasing on my part as well. Yeah, Dan.
I'd have to say, given similar resources and situations, I'm not actually sure how different they are. But I will say that I'm glad Donald Trump is in a country like this one versus in a country like that one.
Where we still have free speech, presumably.
Where we still have free speech, where we still have other bodies of government, where we still have a democratic process. And I may be giving too much credit to, you know, our national processes, our media, our government,
our checks and balances,
to our checks and balances. But I can say that, you know, the last time I ate pizza, it wasn't gray.
The cannot be said the same for North Korea. So in terms of some free speech, we actually have a little update. You know, it's Sunday again as we're sitting here in the studio, and football in the fall happens on Sundays. Last week, we talked a whole bunch about the trauma and drama involved in players expressing their views and kneeling during the national anthem to say, hey, maybe we should have, you know, land of the free and home of the brave, where we don't have to fear for our lives. And because of Trump's involvement in that, became, you know, a huge spectacle. So today we've got one little update, and that's the Baltimore Ravens fans booed athletes who knelt in prayer before the national anthem was performed at Sunday's game. The game's announcer enjoined spectators to pray with the entire Ravens organization and pray that the nation embrace kindness, unity, equality, and justice for all Americans. Initial cheers turned to louder boos as the players knelt in prayer. The Ravens players then stood, along with all the players from the Pittsburgh Steelers, as the anthem was sung. Do you guys understand, like, what's going on here? Because I really don't. You boo them when they kneel during the national anthem. Then you boo them for praying when it doesn't have anything to do with interrupting the national anthem, because they want peace and unity? Like, what's going on here with people booing them?
So I lived in Maryland for 2 years, and I'm amazed that this is how the reaction, because Maryland's actually pretty hyper-religious. I mean, you can't go anywhere without being told to have a blessed day. Or, I mean, the first experience that we had when we moved to Maryland was, what church do you go to? Oh, you don't go to church? Come to ours. I'm amazed that this is the reaction that they got.
So this is not, as one might, you know, think, possibly, one might speculate, a whole bunch of heathen atheists filling the Baltimore Ravens, you know, stadium and booing no. that people are having free speech to kneel and unite in prayer before a game. No, this is not a bunch of atheists booing the prayers before a football game.
And, I mean, basically, this was people booing something that they said that should. I mean, generally, this is a fix to the. They said you can't do any kind of protest or anything during the national anthem, and so they decided to sidestep that by doing it before. And it's not even a protest; it's prayer, and they still hated it.
So it's really anything that involves dropping to the knees will, you know, evoke this boo. Should they, you know, look a little bit closer as to what actually is going on here? Or do they just have this, like, blanket, you know, switch of on and off and on and off? Oh, they're kneeling. It must be. And they're football players in uniform. It must be something that's horrible that I am against and I must boo.
I think the only thing that's going to save us from this predicament is Tim Tebow.
Really?
Tim Tebow, he took a knee.
That's right. He always takes a knee to pray, doesn't he?
He takes a knee, and people loved it. So, I mean, now we found a new job for Tim Tebow.
Okay, so he can lead the pre-national anthem prayers. I don't like where this is going. I don't like this either. But, you know, Tim Tebow is not employed by the NFL either at this point, is he?
No, he's not. Right,
okay, so that might be a comeback for him. Now, as an atheist, I actually feel a little bit uncomfortable with this, because it's not the individual players that are saying, I'm going to express my protest of treatment of black and brown people by police in our country. This is the announcer saying, everyone who came here to enjoy a football game, wait patiently while this particular person has their free speech. This is everyone who came to the football game. Now, please, we invite you to join in this religious exercise. And that seems to be a little bit uncomfortable for me. You know, when we go to the baseball game, and I think if you look back through the Ask an Atheist WA Twitter account, you'll see a picture possibly of Sam sitting with his arms crossed and a ball cap on his head when we went to one of our recent Rainiers games, and they said, please rise and join us as so-and-so performs God Bless America. And so in, you know, true atheist form, Sam stays sitting, and I think I took the ball cap off my head and put it on his head, because please rise and remove your headgear or something like that. Remove your hats. So he's going to sit and keep his hat on, right? Or go out of his way to put on a hat to say, hey, not everyone's going to rise for a patriotic religious song, and
right,
that you're allowed to say, no, I'm not going to participate in that. So I don't know how I feel about the incorporation of, you know, everyone saying, join us as we pray.
I'm okay with being invited as long as the answer no is acceptable. I guess there's a scenario where I would have a problem with it, and that would be, you know, if the NFL were still a nonprofit organization, which they are no longer. They lost their nonprofit designation. So they're a corporate entity. They have the right to sort of do and endorse whatever they want to. And whether or not I agree with what it is they're doing and endorsing is sort of irrelevant to that same constitutional argument that we like to come back to. It's sort of none of my business. I will say I'm not really a big football fan one way or the other. You know, it's, to me, football is a little bit like ballet or opera. You know, it's one of those things that humans do that we wouldn't really be human if we didn't do it. But it's not necessarily something I'm super interested in.
Well, another example would be, so we have a high school football team actually local to here where Satanists had to actually intervene because the coach was actually having his team kneel in prayer. It's a public school, whereas we're talking a private institution.
So we'll just have to see how this keeps unfolding in terms of prayer versus protest at, you know, football stadiums. And to me, I think that it's a good show of unity when you say we're coming together to say, hey, we're sitting here praying for peace and unity and safety for all Americans and things like that, and equality for all Americans, especially when you have so many people that in our states are non-religious, right? And when you say a prayer, I wish they could say we'll have a moment where we collectively meditate on our, you know, united hopes for equality of all Americans. Because when you say it's a prayer, you're dismissing that there's a bunch of non-religious people that aren't wanting to pray for that, but do want to have a minute to recognize, like, that's a communal hope. And I think that's something that can bring people together and without having that booing. And you don't have to mask it with the word prayer. When you have a moment to collectively meditate on it, the people who want to pray and ask their God for that, they can do that. The people that are not can say, hey, I, as a humanist, yeah, I appreciate the sacrifice that you're making or the protest that you are doing right now. And I like that. Yeah. So
I always say like a moment of silence, prayer, or reflection, and just kind of get everybody in there, you know?
Yeah. I'd like to hear from Mikey from Connecticut. And he shot us an email at questions@askanatheist.tv. And he says, asking whether God exists or not is analogous to asking the condition of Schrodinger's cat. We cannot say that the cat is dead or alive until we observe it. In fact, we cannot claim the cat even exists at all until we open a box. Wouldn't God be in a similar superposition until we have definitive evidence that proves one case or the other? Wouldn't this view be more scientifically sound? Dan, take us through this. Can you, like...
Sure, yeah.
I mean, no. I see, like, you know, cat memes all about Schrodinger's cat and Schrodinger's box and things
definitely,
like that.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
So can you take us through, like, what is the Schrodinger's cat? And then and then why is the God thing, you know, why is he asking whether that would be more scientifically sound?
So Schrodinger's cat gets thrown around a lot by, by all kinds of people. But most of them aren't really familiar with what it was supposed to be. Schrodinger was talking about... the position of parts of an atom during decay. So where the electron might be, where the proton might be, whether or not it's lost a neutron or lost a beta particle. In this case, it was a cesium atom that was part of the metaphor. See, people think that it was only the cat that was in the box and maybe the cat died or suffocated, whatever. But Schrodinger's box actually had a cat, a bottle of poison, and a cesium atom in it.
Really?
And the point was that you couldn't know whether the cesium atom had decayed or whether the cat was alive or dead until you open the box to observe. It's a commentary on observation and observing what is unknowable and also how observation changes the experiment.
So that also seems like, you know, the question of whether God exists or not is something that's unknowable. That seems like we always say that's an untestable question, right? From a scientific perspective.
Yeah. But I think Schrodinger's cat is a really bad analogy for this one, because Schrodinger knew that cesium was a thing that existed and that beta particles were a thing that existed and that cats exist, that poison exists, and in fact that boxes exist. So when we're talking about this sort of metaphor for nuclear decay, we're using things that are known to exist, and we can say that the scientific position on this cesium atom, because really the cat was Schrodinger being a little bit silly,
scientists liking cats?
There's a long history of it. Yeah, that's where was I? So when we're talking about,
we
like
can't
the,
know
the
because you're inside
idea,
the box, and we don't know until we open the box where you are.
Right. But the point is, cesium is a thing that exists, and nuclear decay is a thing that exists. We don't actually have any evidence for a god like we have for cesium or cats or poison or even boxes for that matter. What box could we possibly open up to look to see if God is there? In biblical texts, God resides in his heaven above the earth. Well, we've looked above the earth for quite a long distance and frankly found no box to even open to even start this
idea.
There's
no God-labeled box anywhere in outer space somewhere.
Right, right. So the absolute epistemological question of whether or not a god could exist is very similar to the teapot question, where a scientist
who's Bertrand Russell's teapot.
Thank you. Okay. Bertrand Russell's teapot said that there could be a teapot orbiting the Earth at a distance of approximately 100 miles. And because we cannot see a teapot at this distance, it's unknowable whether or not the teapot is there. Well, we have pretty good records of what our space probes and programs have done. And to my knowledge, unless somebody has a great sense of humor out there, nobody has launched a teapot into orbit.
I know what SpaceX's newest plan should be. Forget trying to, you know, put people on Mars.
And even still,
teapot in space.
Once again, we know what a teapot is and that orbit is a thing. It comes back to the, okay, what is this god? How would you detect it? And what box would you open to find it? So can God exist in a quantum superposition of existing and not existing at the same time?
Oh, you use that secret word quantum.
I know, it just means like add a bunch more zeros. Can God exist in a quantum superposition of existing and not existing at the same time? Scientifically? No, not really. Not in the same way that a cesium atom could. But should we maintain the position that a god is possible? I suppose. Like we always say, you can't prove a negative. But where's the evidence for? Like the teapot, you would think there would be something to show us the existence,
Dan,
of this thing.
You're forgetting the trees and the human eye.
No, I think about those things a lot, actually. Trees and human eyes. But when you walk in the woods.
What more evidence do you need for God?
Oh, dear. Are you reading the book on the counter? Have you been reading Made in Heaven again?
I've kind of been raiding the stash here at Sam's house.
Yeah, so we've got, you know, lots of folks that will say, well, this is evidence of God. And I think for an atheist that gets a lot of those questions, it's not a compelling, you know, argument to say that this amazing thing that is observable in nature is then evidence of God. That link between something that you observe in nature and the existence of God, and certainly the existence of any, you know, God that's written about in many of the major holy scriptures, isn't there. It's not a compelling evidence when you use logic and reason to compare those and make those kinds of big statements. And I think that's what you were getting at, Dan, when you talk about epistemologically, right? Epistemology, that how do we know what we know?
Right.
You know, well, we could say, you know, we know that there's trees. We know that a human eye is really complex. We've got a model for how that human eye evolved that is then, you know, supported by many different, you know, aspects of science to
right.
support that model.
It is possible that in the next 25 seconds, a large purple three-legged hippopotamus could spontaneously appear in this room. It is possible. I cannot say that I know that it will not happen. But is there any evidence of such a thing ever occurring in human history? No.
Not to my knowledge. And there's pretty good past experience, right, with our empirical observations that kind of thing generally doesn't happen. That what,
right.
Three-headed, multi-legged, purple hippo? Like this
studio
is
kind of
small.
See, one iteration and the myth has already gotten twisted.
Right. So this studio is pretty small and there's not really hippos in our, you know, 20-mile radius of here, and how would you have it spontaneously like materialize, and would it displace all of the other, there's a, you know, studio console here, there's air in this studio, would it displace all of those? Would then our air compress? Would we have increased air pressure inside our studio? There's all sorts
would
of questions.
Would there just be a loud bang and a flash of lights as we got cavitation bubbles in reality? I don't know. I will reiterate, though, it's sort of just a silly question to compare the existence of God to the existence of cesium, poison, and cats.
Yeah, it's certainly a false equivalency.
So on this, it kind of speaks to me of why agnosticism in terms of knowledge is really seeming to be a very good place to be, seeming to be a very logical place to be. Agnosticism in terms of, do we have knowledge on the existence of God or the non-existence of God? No. So we are therefore agnostic. Gnosis meaning knowledge, agnostic, you know, without that knowledge. We don't have the knowledge of that. In terms of living our day-to-day lives, I'm atheistic in how I execute my daily actions and things like that. I'm humanistic in what guides me and what values guide me in that. But whether I know whether there's a God, no, I'm agnostic on that. Would you guys kind of say that that's your same position?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, except for, I mean, you'd basically have to go, like, what evidence actually would support the existence of a God? And does anything ever actually point to this? And has to be exclusively for God and not explained by something else.
Yeah, that no God of the gaps, the things that we can't explain, where those gaps get smaller and smaller once we gain more knowledge about how our world works and more observation, more empirical evidence, things like that. Am I along the right track? Am I on a similar track as you guys?
My standard is an in-person appearance and three miracles of my choice to be performed on the spot with no prior knowledge, and at least two forms of state-issued ID.
Two forms of state-issued ID. Uh-oh, I think that you're creating some barriers there.
I know, I'm moving the goalposts.
We don't want to have any gatekeeping going on for what's evidence of God.
Do the hippo, sir. Do it. Do the hippo.
The hippo's a miracle? I don't know. Well, this is Ask an Atheist. That's the time that we got for today. Thank you, Josh, and thank you, Dan, for joining me in the studio. I'm your producer, Becky Friedman. Our music is by Chris Coleman and by Phil Whitfield. Tweet us at AskAnAtheistWA. Email questions at AskAnAtheist.tv. Support us by going to AskAnAtheist.tv and contributing to Peggy's Challenge. See Sam on Patreon.com/SamMulvey. And we will see you guys next week. Buenas tardes.